Talkers.
Welcome to No Prize from God, episode 24. No Prize from God features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey, and my guest this episode is Spencer Chamberlain, frontman of the band Under Oath. I've had the pleasure of knowing the Under Oath guys since the late 90s. I think I first was introduced to Spencer probably around 2003. This was a really fantastic, insightful, and frank conversation. Towards the end, you'll hear us mention one of the interviews I did with him over the years, back when he was doing the band Sleepwave. That was conducted on Sleepwave's bandwagon tour vehicle parked behind the Hollywood Palladium while they were on tour. And while I was unaware at the time, I believe it was a pretty dark period in terms of Spencer's personal evolution and struggles with addiction. He's in a much better place now, doing awesome, looks good, sounds good. And of course, if you're listening to this, you probably know that Under Oath has been back together for the last couple of years, putting out new records. And at some point, not long after we recorded this episode, did a live stream performance, which was pretty successful also. I would also recommend, after you listen to this episode, if you enjoyed it, head over to YouTube, go to the KnotFest YouTube channel, and watch the premiere episode of The Disc Dive, a new video interview series that I have with KnotFest. Spencer and I talked about his entire discography, going all the way back to his pre-Under Oath band, as well as all of the Under Oath records that he appears on, and the record he did with Sleepwave. It's very cool, and it touches on some of the things that we talk about in this No Prize from God episode, although nowhere near as in-depth when it comes to his personal beliefs and views and that sort of stuff that we talk about here. If you're an Under Oath fan, you can also check out an earlier episode featuring his bandmate, Tim McTagg, and check out past episodes with Eric July of Backwards, Ryan Clark of Demon Hunter, who's been on the show twice, Nurgle of Behemoth, and many, many more. One more thing I'd like to tell you about before we get into this episode. Head over to Spotify and check out No Prize from God playlist for the podcast. These are songs of inspiration, desperation, and faith from No Prize from God guests, and a diverse range of tracks that deal with the podcast's various themes. As Bono once said in a 2005 Rolling Stone interview, "The music that really turns me on is either running toward God or away from God. Both recognize the pivot, that God is at the center of the jaunt." The playlist at the moment, which is always growing, has close to 200 songs from a very eclectic assemblage of artists. So do check that out. And please, if you're listening in Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star rating and write a nice little review. You can find No Prize from God at noprizefromgod.com, which is a brand new, fully fleshed out website. You can follow No Prize from God on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. So here it is, my conversation with Spencer Chamberlain. This is No Prize from God. Concept of this podcast was that when you look every podcast platform, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, they have a religion and spirituality category. And when you look at that category, it's predominantly right-wing evangelical Christians, prosperity gospel and whatever, militant atheists, you know, like the four horsemen of the atheist apocalypse types, like your Sam Harris's and whatnot, or new agey self-help stuff. And I was looking at it thinking, where's a podcast for everyone else? Like, I don't fall into any of those categories. There's things that I can listen to from each of those categories and maybe get something from, but for the most part, that stuff doesn't really speak to me. And moreover, I was thinking about how in my life, I've encountered so many creative people who have such interesting takes on that stuff and have had such diverse experiences with it. So my concept was conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between. How does the pursuit of life's big questions affect art, you know? Going back to your earliest background and encounter with that stuff, what was presented to you as a kid in terms of the framework that you grew up in and how these kind of questions, life, death, what does it all mean? How was that presented to you early on?
Well, I'm originally from North Carolina. So, you know, it's the Southern, I don't know if North Carolina is considered in the Bible Belt or not. I don't think it is, but you know, it was, everyone went to church, you know, and I don't think it was never really presented like it was later in my life. Like Christians, when I got older, to me were like way more like about that life, I guess, you know, I grew up, like, it was like, you went to church as a kid because your parents made you go and you went to Sunday school and that kind of stuff. You know, my parents were, you know, they installed the morals of what loose basic Christianity was. You know, and we got in trouble if we cursed and stuff like that, but we were young, you know, and but it wasn't as spiritual as what I saw when I came to Florida with the kids, especially the Under Oath guys and a lot of the bands in that movement that were like spending a lot of time, you know, talking to Jesus and stuff like that. Like, that was wild for me to see, because to me it was just like, yeah, I'm a Christian because that's what my family was, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't like I really believed it or knew what I believed, because I don't think any of us do at that age. I don't think most of us do until way later in life.
I completely agree.
I grew up in a home to where we went to church on Sunday, and me and my brother hated it because, you know, it's like Sunday. You want to wake up early. You don't want to dress up. And that was like the things that you were more concerned about at that age, is like, it's your weekend. You wake up early every day for school. You don't want to wake up for church and put on dress clothes that you want to wear. And like, that was what it was more about at that young age. And I never, you know, I don't think I really gave it much thought until a little bit later in my life. And I remember telling my mom one time in the car that I was like, what if I don't believe in any of this stuff? And she got so upset, you know, like you're little, I was probably 12. I was like, yeah, but what if I don't believe in God? You know, like, she was pretty upset about that. But we didn't have really deep spiritual conversations in our family. You know, there was just, we were brought up correctly, I would say, as far as the morals go. And, you know, both my parents, before they were divorced and after, they were both great, you know, as far as teaching us how to be good people was concerned, you know. It wasn't super spiritual. Like, you prayed before, you know, you said your prayer before you went to bed and before you ate and on Sunday school and stuff like that, but nothing really seemed to me, at least, I was the youngest, so maybe I just didn't understand as much, but it wasn't really a spiritual thing for me.
So very much a cultural thing, and just something that was sort of just like, you go to school 5 days a week and you celebrate Thanksgiving, and, you know, it's just part of your
Yeah, you see most of the kids you go to school with at church on Sunday and at Sunday school, you know, that kind of stuff. It was just where we lived and what people did, I think. And I'm not saying that I'm bashing maybe a lot of the parents were spiritual, but I think for a little kid, I don't think that I'm aware of that. I don't think you could comprehend what you're doing or like anything like that.
I mean, it's the biggest questions that humanity has struggled with since the dawn of time. How is a child going to grapple with things that, you know, learned intellectuals haven't solved?
And I've even spoken about that to the band guys. Like, we've been in the bus and, you know, how Underoath started as a Christian band and is no longer a Christian band. And I was like, you know, it parts of me look back. I mean, I know we did a lot of good things for a lot of people and including ourselves. It was like, but I look back a lot of it's like, who wants to listen to like some 23-year-old kid, you know, talking about what's right and what's wrong and like what you're supposed to believe in and sharing that. We know we were never really that preachy, but we did share what we did the band for and why we're on stage. It became like part of our nightly thing on stage, you know? And I look back and I'm like, if I was 30 and saw some 20-year-old kid on stage standing out, I'd be like, what a fucking dumbass. Like, you don't know what you believe. You don't know who you are really at that age. Or at least I didn't.
That's probably what Fat Mike, for example, was thinking, you know?
Yeah.
Understandable, even if some people's attitude towards it was a little abusive or unfair. I can, you know, and you could apply the same thing to, I suppose,
anything.
Like, yeah, bands that have, you know, radical politics and that sort of, yeah.
Yeah, like, who? And I was in love with the mystery of rock and roll. I think me and you have had this conversation before, but I remember not knowing what Tool looked like because they weren't in their music videos and they weren't in the layout, and you'd have to like find a store that sold Circus magazine to buy it to maybe get a live shot, you know, if you weren't old enough like me at the time to even go see them live. You know, it was always like a mystery thing. And like, if I were to put myself in my 12-year-old, 11-year-old shoes, 15-year-old shoes, 16 to 18, whatever, would I give a shit what he believed in and what he worshiped? No.
No.
I still don't. It was about the song and how it made me feel and the lyrics. And even if the lyrics were touching on something spiritual, it didn't matter to me what they were passionately believed in their spare time, you know?
That's the whole thing too about separating the art from the artist. And that even gets into the debate of, you know, do we watch a Roman Polanski movie? Do we listen to a Burzum record? You know, when you get into this, that whole debate, right, about, well, if this, on the extreme end of things, if this art is being created by someone who believes something terrible or has done something terrible. And yeah. And I fall much more in the side of free expression is free expression, and people who believe terrible things and have done terrible things are as entitled to create as anyone else. And yeah, how those things make us, and I'm looking at it from the extremist, most furthest, you know, how those things make us feel and how we interact with that art is up to the individual. But I hate that idea that you can't support this or that art because of one or more of the people behind it and who they are and what they believe, let alone when it comes into ideologies and actions that don't affect other people at all.
Yeah, it shouldn't matter. It's like, you know, I don't care, you know, if you're vegan or not, you know, but if I am, it's something I believed in, which I'm not, but like, if that is something I believed in, and that's like, for me, I never saw, and I use that as a term because I feel like it's like telling someone how to eat seems pretty ridiculous, right?
Mm-hmm.
Telling someone what to believe in is pretty wild. Sharing what you believe in because it affects you and you're passionate about it, I get that, you know?
In an environment where that's been invited, that's right. The other thing, you know?
Yeah, and I think singing a song, you know, like I've said that see, like Killswitch Engage probably has more Christian influence lyrics than Under Oath ever did, which is when we got a lot of backlash for not being a Christian band anymore. I'm like, go listen to the songs. These songs are about my life struggle, myself and Aaron, you know, like the shit that we were going through. Most of it's about dealing with drugs or addictions or, you know, just hard times. Nothing, we weren't really ever singing about God, you know, or anything religious. And I thought that it was just like, you know, and there's bands that do that and that's fine. And I think it's something you're passionate about. You sing about it, you know?
But, and that says something really interesting too about the expectations of some of that portion of the audience, in that they're fine with whatever the songs are actually about and trying to communicate and where the art's coming from, as long as they feel some certainty about what every member of that band believes in private. And it's like,
yeah,
what?
it seems so insane. It's like, yeah. And I compare to that, it's like that reminds me of people that care, or like, why would you care if a member is an atheist or a Satanist? It's like saying that you care that a member is gay or straight. You know what I mean? Like, why would that matter? Why would it matter if the guitar player is gay or not in a band that you love? For someone that does care about, it's like, it's equally saying, it's like, why? So why does it matter that our bass player is an atheist? You know, you say you don't care about these things, but you care about this. That was always confusing to me as we were like branching out from that, you know. I was like, that doesn't make sense, because Grant, our bass player, was the first one to be like, I'm an atheist, and I've been struggling telling you guys this for a long time. You know, like his sister was, he was, you know, and that was one of the first things that was just like, it shouldn't matter. Why does it matter? Like, that's what you believe in, and like, you're okay with it. Like, I'm okay with it. Like, I don't need to tell you how to live. That's like me going, you need to wear these clothes, because these clothes are better than your clothes.
And yeah.
He goes.
And these are the clothes we wear in this band. If you want to be in this band, you got to dress this way.
It's like, but my clothes are better than your clothes. Why would you say that? Because I think they're better than yours. Or the price tag says that they're better than yours. But this guy goes, no, they're not. I like my clothes better than yours. You know what I'm saying? Like, so why does that, is just like such a dumb comparison, but like, I'm trying to make it as stupid as possible. Like, I like chicken better than I like beef, but you like beef better than you like chicken. No, you're wrong. You're wrong. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a stupid thing to like, who cares? It's everyone has are entitled to liking and disliking what they want. It's like a band because you like the band, not because they're Christian or not, or Satanist or not, or, you know, agnostic or not. It should, all that stuff to me doesn't matter. It's like, I've listened to music makes me feel something that it's hard for me to even describe. So why do I need to know what their dietary habits are, or their sexual preference, or their creed, or lack thereof? You know, I don't fucking care. I like it. If I think the music is great, I think the music's great. But that also goes back to what you're saying, is like, if someone in that band has done something terrible, you know, like we all know that Lost Prophet story, like I would never listen to them.
Yeah.
So there is a line somewhere for me. Yeah. I've never really thought about it until you just brought that up. Like,
but something like that guy, you know, he's in prison for what he did. And secondly, what he did was so heinous and was perpetrated on, you know, innocent people. Yeah, I mean, I think it comes down to your personal.
I don't think
feelings either about interacting with it. I wouldn't personally listen to that band, but somebody that
I wouldn't either. Yeah.
That was their favorite band of all time, and it meant so much to them, and they love all the other dudes in the band. If they're still listening, like I wouldn't necessarily take that away from them, but I can't. I wouldn't personally, and I think that's how it should be. Is for each person to be able to decide individually.
You should interact with it. Yeah, you should be able to decide. Like, I was never a fan of R. Kelly, and I watched that documentary, and completely, you know, brutal, hard to watch, just disturbing. And I get the people protesting, and like, you know, don't listen to it, and taking it off iTunes and Spotify and all that stuff. But then there's people that want to still listen to it. Like, are they right or are they wrong? Like,
you know, Michael Jackson. That, you know, there's a long, like Chris Brown. I know people who are good, moral, upright people that will listen to Chris Brown. And if you crack a joke to them about it, they're like, they kind of brush it. Like, they know, but they just love his music. And I don't have that problem because I never cared about Chris Brown's music.
Yeah, same. And I never listened to Lost Prophets. You know, I heard this song on like MTV2 or whatever, and I never it wasn't my scene, you know, and I wasn't an R. Kelly fan or, you know.
Yeah.
But like Michael Jackson comes on, I don't change it. I mean, that was, I remember that being a thing when I was born, you know, like that was like, he was like the biggest pop star. Why are you yelling at me?
just wants voice, cat voices heard. Where's the podcast for cats?
I know, right? But yeah, it's a weird one, but I don't. Yeah, I guess we're getting really sidetracked, but yeah, I don't see why members' religious beliefs would affect a listener, you know, in such a way. Luckily for us, it really hasn't. I know there was a lot of backlash, but like, we haven't seen any change in popularity, you know. And
yeah, in terms of the metrics you can use to measure, you haven't. I mean, it's interesting how Christian music is the only genre, I think we've talked about this before, it's the only genre that's defined by ideology. You know, when you go into the record store, when we used to have record stores, you're like, here's jazz, here's metal, here's hip hop, here's Christian. It's like every one of those other genres is identified by the sound, the style, maybe the region, maybe the culture. And then Christian music is like, oh, this sounds like all sorts of different things. It's
And I think
defined by what the people who made it believe.
Luckily, we never got really thrown in.
No.
The record stores I went into, we were never in that section, and we were never considered Christian gospel or whatever that category is.
And this brings up something important, I think, related to everything we're talking about. And this is, and tell me how you feel about this, because this has been my stance for the last few years. On the one hand, and most importantly, I don't feel that any band artist has a responsibility to disclose what they personally believe. There shouldn't be any sort of compulsion to get somebody to go on the record and say, well, I think this about this. However, on the other hand, I do believe that if an artist, if part of their platform in the beginning, right, and in terms of building their thing was, we stand for this or we stand for that or we believe this, and those beliefs change, then I think there is a responsibility to communicate, like, hey, we've evolved, we've changed, we don't, you know, we changed our minds about this or that, which is our right, but we kind of want everyone to know. And I think that there's a really unique case study with Under Oath, because I think you're one of the few bands of note that's established to the level that you're established that's done that. And I think it's very commendable and brave, knowing that there are other bands right alongside you, right in the same genre, that travel in the same circles. And I don't want to out anybody or place any value judgments, but bands that I know where their audiences think of them as a certain way, and the people in the band don't feel that way anymore, and yet haven't publicly come out and said, hey, we don't believe the way you think we believe. And I liken it to the example I always use is if Rage Against the Machine suddenly became like MAGA Trump people behind the scenes, like, that would be their right, but I feel like before they go on the reunion tour, they should make some sort of announcement that's like, hey, we're all right-wing Republicans now, because they know that part of their platform was what they believed, and that some portion of their audience, you know, is along for the ride because of that. So I'm curious for your thoughts on all of that. And again, I mean, everybody's free to approach things the way that they want. But I remember, you know, when the As I Lay Dying thing went down, that was a conversation that I had with Tim directly. So I was like, hey, none of you owe it to the world to tell people how you believe, except for the fact that you made it an issue in the first place. That's, you know what I mean? Like, that's kind of on you then to then say, hey, I changed my mind.
I think Under Oath was a weird anomaly because I think we were very much struggling in the public eye, if that makes any sense. I think it does. I think it was very unfortunate for me at the time, but in hindsight, maybe a good thing, like, overall, because it helped all of this, is like, people knew that I was struggling with drugs and with the band, and Aaron was at a rift with the band, and we were like, we broke up so many times and got back together, like, we were falling apart all the time. And I think maybe our fans were just so, we had a great relationship, and we still do with you know, we were always meeting those people and we'd have real conversations. And I think people knew that we were having a hard time, like, withholding this label that we had. And I think that people knew that we weren't perfect, or, and we weren't pretending to be. I think we shared what we believed in at one point as a band, and then it probably went on longer than we should have sharing it. But we never force fed anything, and we never really sang about anything. So I think it was just a weird anomaly that we kind of fell apart. Our fans watched us, like, go through all these growing pains. Like, we fell apart and got back together, picked up the pieces and dust ourselves off a couple times before completely, you know, falling apart and saying we're never going to do it again, to forgiving each other and getting back together. It was like a bad reality show. You know, it's like it was full of drama and stuff that I wish people didn't know or see from us. And it kind of feels gross at times, but, like, I think everyone kind of saw it, you know?
And I think that was, unbeknownst to you at the time, as you're living it, a great teaching and living by example moment, in that undoubtedly a significant portion of your audience was struggling in the same way. I mean, that's life, you know, whether it was with their personal convictions or whether it was with people around them, or feeling difficulty in relating to the people in their group, where maybe they all used to feel a certain way and now some of them feel differently, and how do you address that? And of course, addiction affects everyone, all walks of life, regardless of belief. So I think that, yeah, as painful as it was and as embarrassing as it can be, you know, to be so exposed in that, you know, Metallica, some kind of monster sort of way.
Yeah.
It's part of what makes people cling to you and the music you make, is they feel like they know you, and they feel like you're real, you know?
And I do know that we did lose some fans to it, like some super, you know, conservative Christian people that listened to us just because we were a Christian band. But I think most people, as we were touring it, it was a shock when they found out, or they heard me say something from stage, like something like that. Like, I think most people were like, oh, you know, I don't think we had like a predominantly Christian audience.
I don't think so either.
I think we had a very secular audience, mixed audience, as it should be. It's art, it's music, it's for everyone. I always felt that way. Like, you know, when I met the guys, I was like, I love music first before anything. I care about music first. And those guys were like, well, I care about, you know, at the time they were very much the opposite. Like, well, we're close, but, you know, we switch.
Yeah.
We care about the message first and Jesus first and then the music. And I was like, well, I've been doing this since I was like a baby, you know, like this is my life, before I even knew what I believed in. And then at that younger age, you know, late teens, early 20s, you think you know what you believe in, but, you know, that changes too. You know, obviously it changed for all of us. And I think, you know, we just happen to be in the public eye going through those changes. And I think that's why, like, the real Under Oath fans stuck by our side, and most people didn't care.
100%. And regardless of what those fans believe. And I also would say that there's all sorts of segments of the audience. And I think one segment is also those that are kind of like, you know, and for people listening, Spencer and I are talking about ourselves. We're not saying, oh, people that are like that. We were people in our early 20s going around acting like we knew what was what about everything. Exactly. And I think, you know, a lot of your audience probably went through those same transitions and have stuck with you because they see themselves in it too. Or maybe they were 15, 16, listening to Under Oath for the first time and thinking they knew everything. And then we're evolving along with the band, you know, and then that they feel a sense of belonging and connectedness that persists. And I also think for me personally, the best art comes from intention and authenticity. So if I were to only to listen to music or watch movies or read books or comic books or whatever that were made by people that believe exactly what I believe spiritually, politically, all across the line, I wouldn't be able to listen to anything. I'd have to make solo records and just listen to them and not.
And I just personally, like, even when I thought I knew everything and Under Oath thought we knew everything, like, it's funny that I didn't care about, like, when I was listening to a band, what they believed in, even though we felt like we needed to say what we believed in and share. You know, I didn't care what others believed in, which is weird. Like, I listened to everything. Like, it didn't matter to me. I wasn't going to change my musical taste because I had found, you know, I had found Jesus or whatever. You know, I didn't, like, go throw out my Nine Inch Nails records. It's been my favorite, one of my favorite bands since I was a little kid, or Tool, or, you know.
And a lot of the, folks who did that then find themselves tracking all those records down a few years later, even if they're still a devout Christian. They go, I was maybe a little too uptight. I can listen to those records. I wish I hadn't thrown those away.
Yeah. I don't know. It was definitely a weird time when I look back on it, but I'm like, I know what we were trying to do is kind of maybe be more of a light in a dark situation. Cause I think what was happening around us, there's a lot of just bad shit, you know, like, and I think even the stuff that I was going through, it was nice to share something positive. Cause I feel like all of our songs, I mean, a lot of our songs are pretty dark, you know, and they're pretty brutal as far as the lyrical content. It's a lot of it's pretty sad, depressing stuff. It was nice to share something a little bit uplifting, I think, on stage. Even as I was getting out of, maybe I don't believe this or maybe I do, there was things that I always struggled with. You know, like I said, like when I moved to Florida and saw these people like living for Jesus so devoutly and like sitting in circles and praying together and speaking about how they, you know, their relationships with God. I'm like, this is weird.
That was my very next question. Yeah. Because I didn't grow up in that same sort of, I guess you would call it non-denominational evangelical sort of framework. I mean, my family's Catholic on my dad's side, but he hasn't been really much of a practicing Catholic for any point in my life. And then Presbyterian on my mom's side. And neither of those faith traditions had a lot of the things that we would associate with the predominant kind of Christian culture now, and the Christian culture as it was existed in that Tooth and Nail, Face Down Records scene of, you know, the late 90s and early 2000s. So, you know, I found myself in a lot of situations probably similar to you, where I would be with a group of people and I'd be like, yeah, we essentially believe the same things on paper, but man, this feels weird. Some of this stuff that's people are doing.
Well, like, you know, I had lived some before I like decided that I was going to dive deeper into that spiritual side of my life. And I was just, and, you know, I think I was just trying to figure out who I was, and, you know, a lot of that stuff for, sorry, I just don't know if you can hear that or not. My dog is freaking out. I don't know if, it's that confusing for everyone, but I felt like in my late teens, early 20s, it was just confusing, like trying to figure out who you were, you know. Like, I always wrote songs since I was like 11 or 12 years old. Like, I would write songs faster than I would like learn someone else's songs. I always had ideas and hummed this stuff and just made up words and lyrics and stuff that didn't really mean, you know, just being a kid and playing in my room and whatever. But like, figuring out who you are and what you believed in, and everyone around me, and like these other bands on Tooth and Nail and stuff, I'm just like, these dudes are like really passionate and know or very sure. And I felt myself like, I'd never done like these Bible studies where a bunch of 20-year-old men, like, you know, are sitting around talking about this stuff together. Like, this seems weird, but like, I was open to it, you know, and I wanted to learn more. And I was, and I liked that the dudes around me were positive, because I felt like I did leave home at such a young age. I'm on tour and I'm no longer around my older brother, my older stepbrothers, and, you know, like people that kept me accountable. Like, I didn't really know where I would teeter in as far as real life went. You know, like, I think it's pretty scary, you know, not going to college and you get in a van with a bunch of dudes and you're on tour with a bunch of older guys and people are drinking and, you know, doing shit that they maybe should or shouldn't be doing, or depending on how you view it and at the time. And it was just like, it was nice to be around people that were, I think that was my biggest attraction to what we were doing, is that it was nice to be around people that were like, I felt like not looking out to take advantage of you or hurt you or anything. They were, you know, looking out for the greater good of like all of us. Like, we should lift each other up and be there for each other, even though they really weren't, in my opinion. But at first it seemed very, it was very attractive to me, you know, like, yeah, being around a bunch of dudes that like want to be better people and want to, you know, we're not out here like fucking each other over and kicking each other's asses and stealing, you know, like,
yeah,
it didn't seem like scary or violent. It felt like, it felt safe, I think. And that was like, that was attractive to me at that young age. And, you know, my first band I've been in without, well, I was in a couple bands without my older brother, but they were with like my little schoolmates at the time, you know, like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
First band I've been in with some other adults. Some guys are older than me, you know, and I didn't grow up with these guys. I don't really know. We didn't go to school together, and I'm out here on the road. Now I'm traveling all over the country in a van. And it was nice to feel safe, you know, that we were all kind of looking out to be better people, you know?
Yeah, much different than if you had, like, joined the Sex Pistols in 1978.
Yeah.
You know, like, thrown into total chaos.
Yeah, even some of the kids, you know, like, I grew up around, and, like, some, you know, kids that end up getting arrested or, you know, stealing a car or, you know, like, selling drugs or whatever. Like, there is – it was nice being like, well, I didn't go to college and I chose to do this, but I'm, like, I'm in an environment to where – the idea that it was a Christian band, and that's what I believed in too. And these guys are way more involved in it than I am, and I can learn something from them, and it'll be a positive thing. And I can focus on the music because there's not all this other shit going on. Like, the merch guy isn't going to steal something from my backpack, and like, you know, there's not a fight going on, even though there were fights in the crowd, but there's not like, you know, just weird
sketch. Yeah. Everybody's not trying to pass out backstage passes to all the prettiest girls in the audience
That never happened, you know, like, even when we were on tour with bands that you heard those stories about, like, you know, we never saw that shit really happen. So it was like, we did secular tours and it was always chill, because I think people are like, yeah, we respect this band, they make good music, but they're Christian, you know, so
we don't want to get too rowdy in front of them.
maybe. Yeah. We always told people to just be themselves. And I don't think people really held back around us, but it just felt like we did grow up. You know, the first couple of years were a pretty safe environment and like productive. And my memories are pretty happy from that time.
That's awesome. Yeah. Now, at what point did you start to feel, and I don't want to speak for you, but my impression was that as someone who's views on this stuff was much more personal and a quiet sort of faith, so to speak, being the front man for a band, you know, the person who's not wearing an instrument, who's right out there, who's, you know, speaking and screaming the words. At what point did you kind of start to feel this pressure of people were looking to you as some sort of minister, or faith leader, or that they needed something from you that you weren't comfortable or prepared to give?
I think that I don't think I ever really felt that 100%. I think I felt like I always felt, you know, being in a band, I felt like it was my job to share how I felt, you know, not necessarily, even when we were like in the very first stage of like, we're a Christian band and we're like, you know, Speed, make sure you say something about it. And I was like, yeah, for sure. Like, I love telling people what we believe in, but we never forced anything. We never preached. I never did. And I just felt like it was my job to share. Like, I felt like a lot of people were like me, like you grew up and you were kind of like the oddball, you know, and got picked on or whatever for being different. And music was always the thing that I really related to. And most of my friends didn't relate to the same music that I did. And I found it very frustrating. So I was like, I need to make sure I'm supplying those kind of feelings and lyrics for kids like me that feel this way, that alienate, you know, they're alienated and they don't feel like they belong. And they've, you know, I wanted to make people feel like they weren't alone. You know, that was always my goal. Cause that's how I felt listening to the bands that I did growing up. You know, it did give me a lot of hope when I was, you know, growing up in North Carolina where shit was weird sometimes, you know, like definitely was the only kid that listened to and looked like I did in my school most of the time, you know? And I think that's more what I was thinking about. I never really felt this like, oh, I need to preach. Cause I don't preach, you know, like, you know, and I just was like, the kids would talk to Chris a lot, you know, behind the van, or he was the guy that was always like trying to pray with people and stuff. I never did that. I would just kind of walk away and kids would ask. And I was like, oh, you don't, you know, want me to do that, but we can talk about like your real life. You know, I'd say that a lot. And I didn't know if that was the wrong thing to say, but I would always be like, yeah, well, we can talk about what's going on.
What's going on at school? What's up with your parents? How's your boyfriend, girlfriend? You know,
but if you want someone to like preach Bible verses or pray for you, like those dudes are over there.
And that helps that you had that many people in your band too, that you could say that guy. Yeah.
And everyone was pretty approachable for the most part, you know? But like, yeah, I would talk to kids about other things, you know? And I think as that went on, the longer it went on, and I just, I felt the Christian weight I felt the most was the band not being able to tell the guys that I was struggling with certain things, because my fear was they'll kick me out and this is my life and I've worked so hard, you know, these are my songs, this is my life, these are my stories, you know, and like, this is all I care about. And they did, you know, the minute they found out that I was struggling with something, they did kick me out. You know, that was the famous 2006 Warped Tour, like Under Oath leaving. It's all Fat Mike's fault. It was not Christian to use drugs, so I was out of the band, you know, and that's what I fear. And that's why, you know, it was very, and that was probably my biggest turning point in the religion, calling myself a Christian, no matter what I believed in. I was like, humans are wrong. You know, like that's not how you handle it. Even though what I was doing was wrong, what they did was equally wrong. Just because you're not doing the drug, but alienating someone and giving them the boot. And
it reminds me of this saying about how the church is the only hospital that turns away sick people.
Yeah. I mean, that
you're having problems. You know, you're out of here. Wait a minute. What?
I was struggling and dealing with a lot. I mean, the band was changing. We were blowing up and, you know, I was alone. These guys were getting married and I was kind of dabbling in drugs and hanging out with other people maybe I shouldn't be hanging out with and having a good time. And then I realized it was like, oh, I probably shouldn't be doing this. And I started talking to our A&R, and he was the dude that flew out and just told everybody. And I was like, oh, you're like the spiritual leader of this band. Apparently, you know, you're like in your 40s. And I'm like, yo, I might need some help. I'm struggling. And this dude comes out and just intervention, you know, your singer's doing this. And like, I just thought he wanted me gone. I was like, oh, this is not a Christian thing at all. Like,
I'm actually glad you brought that up, because that was something I really wanted to get into if it came up organically, which it just did, which is that you know, there are a lot of misconceptions about how the Christian music industry works, and particularly as it relates to subculture. For the most part, just for people who are outside of the Christian bubble to understand, people that work at labels like Tooth and Nail and so on and so forth, they're just people, and you know, and predominantly Christian and so on and whatever. However, with that being said, there was, especially at that time, a lot of rules that were very surface level about what bands could or couldn't do, whether it's, you know, using profanity in their songs or on stage, or, you know, I remember once upon a time when the Zeo Liberate record came out, Christian bookstores returned all of the CDs to the label and they had to destroy the booklets and make new ones because in one of the band photos, you could see a pinup girl tattoo on somebody's arm. And
oh my God, I never heard that.
Yeah. And that, and this is like, you know, I mean, it used to be extremely rigid in that sense. And it was always frustrating for me because behind the scenes, it was sort of an attitude almost that, and I'm sure you felt this, and I don't want to go off on a tangent, but it's almost like everyone would have been fine with you continuing to use and party behind the scenes as long as nobody knew about it. It was almost more like it was the idea of it being out in the open was worse than the idea of it actually happening.
Yeah. In the, and at this point too, I wasn't using shit on tour yet. Mm. It later became like at home on tour and in the studio, but at, what I never would use before I'd play. I took my job very seriously. As you, I think the best way to prove that point is if you listen to Under Oath's discography from Chasing Safety to Erase Me and hear the how much my voice has progressed, is because I love singing and being a front man and playing music, and I take it very seriously. And you can hear it. The proof is in the records. Like, I practice every day. I warm up before I do anything, be at home or at practice, before every show, before every studio, whatever. Like, I've taken what I do very seriously. So I never let drugs like affect a live performance. But at this point in the 2006 Warped Tour, for example, I wasn't using it on tour even after the shows. It was later where I started using after the show, because I'm like, oh, I'm done. Work. Clock, you know, like how someone opens a beer when they get home from work. That was like yeah, you know, let loose for a little bit. But at this point, so I went all of that Warped Tour without using drugs, which is long enough to pretty much, you know, get it out of your system. And the last 2 weeks get kicked out of the band for using drugs on Warped Tour. You know, it was because I was struggling in my brain, like, man, I shouldn't be doing this, and I know I shouldn't be doing this, and I'm really enjoying it. When I'm doing it, I'm not thinking about it, but then the next day, I'm like really conflicted, and I feel like I have a problem, or if I don't look out, this has become a really dangerous problem, which it did. And it's kind of a miracle that I survived that, because what happened after, you know, like on the bus and going home, getting kicked out of the band for trying to talk to, you know, trying to like,
to actually try to address it in some small steps.
Well, I wasn't even ready to address it yet. That was the funny part, is I had told one person, and that person decided to come out and tell the band.
And that was where I was going with that Christian industry tangent, is there is an idea, and I don't know how much it persists or where it persists, but in that particular moment, I remember your A&R person. You know, for people that don't understand an A&R person, you know, artist and repertoire, like we when you hear the phrase A&R, you think mostly about people that go out into shows and whatever and discover bands and offer them record deals. But that job actually gets a lot more intensive, because it's certainly discovering talent is a big part of it, but developing talent is the bigger part of it. Once the band is on the label, the A&R person is your conduit. You know, your management, your band, that's primarily who you're talking to, who's then communicating all the different things that need to be delegated out to marketing and press and radio and whatever. And that person becomes, in a lot of cases, an advisor, a mentor, a friend. And it gets really complicated and tricky in the Christian world, because that person can sometimes, and particularly in Under Oath's case, in that moment, takes on this pastoral role, It's not just, here's the lead singer calling the A&R person to talk about this issue that could have an impact on the band. There's this, whether you invited it or not, it's also like you're a congregant calling your pastor. And that's right. and not to put a judgment on anybody in that situation, but that just seems like a recipe for disaster, you know, with hindsight being 2020.
I mean obviously everything has worked out and I'm still here and clean and the band is back together and I feel like everything happens for a reason, but that was a really weird time. And I think it was like my biggest fear is exactly what happened. I wasn't fearing of like overdose. I was fearing what they would think of me, you know? And it was like, oh yeah, you're out, you know, like get the fuck out of here kind of a thing. How could you do this to us? How could you do this? You know? And that was like, I think that was the biggest fear. And like, I think a lot of the using was because I just needed an escape. I needed something that was mine. And to, you know, it was just like something that I did on my own, you know, something that was just like, I was like, this is my time, you know, not making any excuses for it.
It wasn't a straight edge band. That's another thing that gets tricky too, right?
Christian
culture is very picky and choosy about which substances are allowed.
Now it's like I see the whiskey, beer, and Jesus t-shirts and shit like that. I'm like,
you're like where was that in 2004? I could have used that.
The funny thing is some of us did drink. If you were over 21, and when we turned 21, I mean, we kind of hit it a little bit on the 2004 Warped Tour. Me and the tour manager and James, our guitar player, we definitely went out for like beers one time when the bus broke down, but we didn't drink all the time. And then on the 2006 Warped Tour, we were like drinking around the other bands. You know, you would like walk through the parking lot of the bands, we parked and everyone's out hanging out drinking. Like we would be out there doing that. I don't know if everyone drank at the time. Maybe Tim and Chris didn't yet, but I think everyone else did.
Beards, not beers, bro.
Yeah.
And by the way, I say this as a straight edge dude, so I'm not, you know, knocking it in either direction, but it's interesting now even watching Christian culture struggle with marijuana, because if people are just doing the render unto Caesar, what's allowable under the law, it's legal in so many places. And I know I know a lot of Christians are doing it. Not all of them are open about it. Some are open about it. It's interesting watching that change take place.
There is health benefits to it. Like my girlfriend, for example, has some stomach problems, and the state of Florida they gave her a medical marijuana license, you know, and that, I mean, for some people, they see that as not cool or whatever, but it helps her a lot, you know, and it's like, it's funny, like, medical marijuana could be, or legal marijuana, but it's okay to have a beer. You know, all that stuff doesn't concern me really anymore. I find it funny, but I also was like, yeah, but our band was that same way at that age too. So maybe it's growing pains of.
Yeah. It's trying to exercise some kind of control over, and it's interesting too, because I think a lot of the picking and choosing that happens, a lot of the things that get turned into theology, bad theology, is really culture. And like we were talking about at the very beginning about how, well, it's easy. We don't have a dog in the fight about whether or not to listen to R. Kelly, because we didn't anyway. And I think that happens a lot with Christian culture, where, oh, well, we'll ignore the thing in the Old Testament about mixing different kinds of fabric and what kind of shellfish you can eat. But we're going to be really hung up on, you know, homosexuality or this or that or whatever. I think it's because it's a lot of people where they never listen to R. Kelly, so they don't care. You know, it's a cultural thing. They do wear mixed fabrics and want to eat shellfish, so they can explain those away.
That was a huge thing for me too, is the longer we toured, like, I think the other things that were bothering me about Christianity before even the band first time they kicked me out, before that, like, meeting other bands and them being like, oh, well, the outsider's not understanding of Christianity was hard for me, because I was a Christian, but I wasn't like fucking gung ho. I'm going to stand on the stage and preach to you. And, you know,
and you weren't going to do apologetics when someone from another band was like, so do you believe in Young Earth? Do you believe in this and that? You're not the guy that's going to be like, whoa. So, you know what I mean? Like, yeah.
And then meeting kids and touring kids that were bisexual or homosexual, and they're like, oh, well, you're that band. You're not supposed to be my friend. And I just like, wait a minute. Like, I don't care about that kind of stuff. Why would you? Well, everyone thinks that you guys hate this. And I'm just like, I can't go down like that. You know, like, I just couldn't be associated with even the thought of people thinking that we have any sort of like disagreements with how people live their lives as far as that was concerned, like sexuality and,
or a problem with who they are, you know?
Yeah. And problem with what you believe in. Like, I felt like, man, do we really want everyone to believe what we believe? Is that's not the goal here. It never seemed like that was ever the goal. I think it was just, I think everyone under oath had good intentions. Like, under oath, we all had that. We just wanted to share what we believed in because it helped us. And then as I think the band got bigger than we ever even dreamed in our wildest dreams. And then we're like, whoa, there's a lot that comes with the word Christian, you know, and good and bad and confusing. And it was just like, to me, it was just like, why do we need to put that word on it? You know, like, Do we need to say like, you know, like, I just don't understand it. I didn't get it, you know?
I remember something Jesse Smith said to me years ago. He was like, if I quit playing drums and became a plumber, would I be a Christian plumber? Would people hire my plumbing business because it's the Christian plumbing business and not just the plumber, you know? Like, and some people would, and that's the whole other sad fact on the other side of it.
Well, and I think this too, the biggest thing for me, which is half the reason why the band got back together after Disambiguation, after like the big breakup, what we all thought was done for good, is I think being in a band is tough. It's like being married to five other dudes, and then you got crew, you got team, you know, management and label. And
usually it's not only like being married, it's like being married to your high school girlfriend.
Yeah.
You know, not like something that you chose for life to be associated and together.
And expecting everyone to believe the same thing, going through life, dealing with marriages, kids, divorces, death, addictions, inner struggle, like, you name it, depression, you know, you name it, and then go, but we all have to believe the same thing before we get up on that stage. You know, it's just really unfair. And I think that was one of the first conversations. It's just like, when we were deciding not to be a Christian band, it was just like, as much as I don't care if the listener is vegan or straight edge or gay or straight or black or white or agnostic or, you know, Jewish, it doesn't matter if my bass player is either, or my guitar player, or me, you know, like, it shouldn't matter. That's like, it's as far as our music goes, like, if we were a gospel band, that's different, you know, but we weren't, you know. I think there was one song that was ever directly Jesus, we love you, and that was on Chasing Safety, and it was written by the singer of Copeland, you know, the guest vocaled on it, like, that he wrote most of that, you know, and that was probably the most religious song we ever had. And I was on our first record before we could even drink, you know, like, we're a baby. And, you know, and I don't think it was wrong to write it. I'm just saying, like, we weren't like a gospel band. It's not like, okay, we're going to get up on stage and sing about Jesus and how much we love him, and but now we're going to say we don't believe in it. It was just like, no, we're going to get up there and sing about the life struggles that we've been singing about the whole time. I mean, go read the lyrics, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's why, I guess if you want to call it getting away with it by changing what, you know, we didn't go back on, we're not like deleting our catalog. We're not playing those songs. You know, we even played that song, Some Seat Forgiveness, on the Rebirth tour. You know,
it's a time and place. It marks a chapter in your life. That's how art and music should be. And people should, you know, especially when you think about, like, when you look at really big, important artists and the scope of their catalog, and you go like, well, you know, George Harrison was really into Krishna consciousness for a long time, you know, and Bob Dylan had like his Christian phase. And what, like, are we going to discount all of that stuff, you know, or say that you shouldn't? Yeah, I mean, I don't think that makes any sense. I did want to ask you, shifting gears in a sense and getting more into the fun part of it. Do you consider yourself, you know, we've talked a lot about music being the driving force in your life, the consistent thing, the thing that's continues to drive you to create, and a part of a big, such an important part of how you experience and see the world. Do you find that you draw a certain sense of spirituality or a certain connectedness or otherworldliness from music, from that creation process and that immersion and experiencing it? Is that part of your life?
I think there's a spiritual side to, you know, writing lyrics and the big question of, you know, what is this and what is death and what are we and how, you know, we talk about it all the time, but I wouldn't consider myself a Christian by any means. I'm not practicing. I don't believe in a lot of the things in the Bible or the stances that Christians take. And I was also dealt a pretty rough time with dealing with Christians and being alienated by Christian human beings. Do I hate Christianity? Absolutely not. Do I think people are wrong for believing it? I don't. I feel like everyone is on a journey to figure out what works best for them and what they believe in. And I think there's times in your life where you think you haven't figured out. I think there's times in your life where you have a lot of doubt. And I'm not in a spot where I think I have a lot of doubt. I think that might've been 2006 and 7, like where I was really struggling and very confused. And now I've like accepted that I don't think I'm meant to know for sure what is what. And I feel like there's a beauty in that. Like I live life with an open mind and hopeful, and, you know, I fantasize about what possibilities could be after life, and if there is any. And sometimes it scares me and sometimes it's fascinating. And, you know, I don't live in this, like, I'm lost, I need to find Jesus again, or I'm living in doubt or whatever. I just don't agree with a lot of the Christianity lifestyle. And I guess it's funny that hearing myself say that, because as we were talking about in the beginning, like growing up in North Carolina, it was just kind of like a cultural lifestyle that I saw, you know, like you went to church because I think you were supposed to. Do I think my mom believed it the way that some of the Unearth guys did when I met them? I don't think so. I think it was more like, oh, if I don't go to church, so-and-so down the street says that she didn't see me there and something must be wrong, or, you know, like, I think that was a lot of, at least back in that day in North Carolina, you know, I think it was just something you were supposed to do. And then I did come into a point where I thought it was right for me, and I thought I knew what I was and knew what I wanted. And then I think I don't think it's wrong for everyone. I just don't think that it's definite. And to me, I can't believe in something that I'm not. I don't know. It's just not for me, you know, and I don't hate on it. And I don't, there's things that I, you know, there's things about it that has taught me a lot, and I don't bash it. Even though I was like treated pretty shitty by Christians around me, but I was, you know, it's like I took it with a grain of salt. It was just what we were all going through, and no one knew what the fuck they were doing. And I think that was the biggest thing for me, is like, we all stood up, pretended like we knew what was best for everyone. And that is very gross to me.
And dangerous from any mindset, religious, political,
yeah,
lifestyle. You know, you can share what works for you, but exactly, when you start getting the attitude that what works for you is the absolute and should be work, and everyone who isn't where you are is simply lost, or, you know, that concept,
like you're more enlightened than they are.
Yeah.
And that was always something that would just be like,
well, you know, a consistent thing that comes up on this podcast a lot, I feel like it comes up from the guests. Maybe it's also me forcing it because it's where I'm at. But I hear myself saying this a lot. I have found that my biggest obstacle for years was my pursuit of certainty and needing to be like this. And that isn't to say that I don't have core principles and, you know, you shouldn't murder, you shouldn't steal. And, you know, I believe in a higher power, and I, you know, and I'm comfortable within the Christian tradition in so much as what I understand about it historically, and certainly not how it's perceived today. But what I've found the biggest turning point for me as an adult and more in recent years is embracing the uncertainty, embracing the doubt, embracing the skepticism, the mystery, the wonder, almost bringing us full circle to, like you were saying, you didn't need to see what Maynard Keenan's eating for breakfast. If anything, that might take something away from the experience of listening to Tool. And it's the same thing where I'm approaching life's biggest questions from a standpoint of the doubt is exciting. The mystery is incredible. The not knowing, the knowing is in the not knowing. The certainty is in the uncertainty. And it sounds like a bunch of gobbledygook to people that are really attached to militant atheism or hardcore Christianity or Islam or what, you know, go down the list. But I think that when I really started feeling like getting the answers is when I stopped asking the questions, if that makes sense. It's like, there's just so, or I don't know, maybe a better way to put it is the questions are the answers. Like, so I'm finding happiness and peace and contentment more in the margins. And one of the things I really enjoy about doing this podcast is talking to so many people who have had such different experiences all over the spectrum and different understandings. You know, I had Karen Crisis from a band called Gospel of the Witches on, and she considers herself a spiritual medium. She sees ghosts. She communicates with spirits and, you know, a bunch of stuff that's, you know, I don't hear it and go, yeah, that sounds right. But I listen to it and I engage and I want to hear her experience. I want to hear what led her there. I want to know about her. And I don't sit here and go, what a crazy person or what a lost person or what. I just,
yeah,
just another person, man. Like just, you know, just interesting things to hear and engage in and to live in the mystery and to try to, you know, and to approach it with my own anchor, I guess, but to always be open. And this is the hardest thing in my life. To always be open to new information and to taking that new information and being changed by it.
And being open-minded about it. That's like that's the beauty that I found in the last handful of years, is like being open-minded to all these different possibilities and like you were saying, like meeting different people that have these experiences and when they believe something that I don't, not be like, what a lunatic, but also not be like, oh, okay.
Right. Exactly.
I'll believe that too. It's just being open-minded and there's like some sort of beauty in it and just like taking it all with an open mind, which is, it sounds easier than it is. I think a lot of people,
it's easy to pay lip service to. Yeah. But yeah, it's a lot harder to live.
But like to actually listen and be like, well, this person really has these experiences and says they have these experiences and believes they have these experiences, and not think that they're crazy and not like, oh, I'm just going to hop on the train and believe this now. Like, to just take information and be like, whoa, okay. So people experience different things. Like, we are all so very different. Like, what could possibly be going on in someone else's mind, heart, and how they feel spiritually is up to them and the life that they lead and where they got to where they are today. And they might be somewhere different tomorrow. And I think it, in the drop of a dime, something can change your life completely, drastically. You know, you might be talking 5 years from now and you might feel opposite to the way you do right now.
And I think that's okay. That's not, we came from a scene where that's selling out, that's compromising, that's being moved by the world. And that's garbage, man. That's like, what are we doing here if we're never changing, if we're stuck in the exact same spot forever?
And I think that's why, another reason why I don't call myself a Christian is because I'm completely open-minded to embracing life and trying to, you know, and like you said, you do have the core morals, like don't lie, cheat, or steal, and kill, and, you know, like that kind of stuff. Like, that was instilled in me as a kid. You know, I want to be a better person. Every day I want to be better than I was yesterday. Not just better at singing and playing guitar and piano, and or just like a better dude. You know, like I want to like do more for myself and for my family and for my friends and for the world. You know, I want to, you know, and my role has been writing songs about depression and addiction and sharing my stories. It's almost like getting naked in front of everyone and just like, here I am, you know, like that's my job. You know, as far as I know right now, like that's what I've been doing. And even since the beginning of me being an under oath, that's how it's always been, is I'm just trying to be transparent with my life. And I don't expect everyone to relate to it. And I don't expect, you know, that's why we're not the size of U2. I think lyrically there's a group of people that relate to it. And that's where Under Oath stands, you know,
in the margins, in the unknowing. Yeah. That's where that's the place where there are more of us in those margins than are willing to admit it. You know, there are people, hopefully, there are people listening to this right now who are presenting a certain version of themselves that isn't true to who they are. And if there's anything to take away from this conversation, embrace those contradictions and embrace that unknowing and trust in the people around you, that if they're really meant to be around you, that they will embrace you for who you really are.
And if they throw you out, you'll be fine. You know, like,
right.
And that's too a scary thing. I think, you know, looking back on my life is like, I could have taken that and, you know, jumped off a bridge or whatever. But like, I was like, I'm going to be okay. I'm going to be fine. You know, for a lot of people, they would probably dive deeper down the spiral, but you don't have to do that. And I think, you know, Under Oath has always been about that inner demon and the struggle, be it suicidal thoughts or depression or addiction or just bullshit in life, like, you know, divorce or whatever. You know, we write it out there because we live through it. You know, like we just tell the truth of our lives, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the same for everyone. But we're hoping that hopefully someone can feel not alone and be okay to face those feelings. And like, cause the longer you bottle it up and the longer you like run from it, the more dangerous it becomes, you know, which is why we have a lot of mental health problems in our country. Cause there's some stigma about talking about it that makes people feel lesser than, but I don't think anyone should ever feel lesser than for dealing with a depressive thought or a suicidal thought or dealing with addictions and stuff that, you know, most people are hiding that. And I think the more we learn to speak with each other about it and share our true feelings and where we're actually coming from, not where you're supposed to be. You know, that was another thing with Under Oath, is I was supposed to be this certain way and it wasn't. I was clearly hiding it behind closed doors. And I just started writing it in the songs and then started talking about it eventually, you know, but the more we communicate with one another about what's really going on and how you really feel, the happier and healthier you'll be. I've never been happier, even on my dark days, you know, because I got that out of the way. You know, I've like, people know my struggles and I've talked to people about it and share my story. And some people relate, some people don't. You know, there's guys in the band that don't relate with me at all. They don't relate with our own lyrics, 0%.
And that's okay. That's great. Yeah. Yeah.
So, my advice is learning how to, you know, accept that it's okay to not be okay, I guess, you know.
Perfectly said. And I would add, and this might be a conversation for another time even, but one of the takeaways from your story that I draw is something that I've been thinking about a lot lately as well, is the idea, the conflict between restorative justice and punitive justice. Punitive justice is, wait, you're doing this stuff? You're out. We're casting you away. Restorative justice is, how can we understand what's going on? How can we help, if that's even what you need? How can we, you know, and that's on a personal lifestyle scale, but even broadening that out to, you know, our legal system and our whole attitude of crime and punishment. And especially when it comes to thought crimes, people believing the wrong things, saying the wrong things, being using the wrong language, at what point do we become restorative as opposed to punitive? You know, do we cast everyone out of society who said or did the wrong thing, or do we teach and restore? And, you know, am I talking about murderers and rapists? And well, that's one extreme, but overall, what I'm really talking about is finding a way to heal and learn from each other and restore and build one another up when we stumble, as opposed to punish and banish.
Yeah. And I agree with that. It's a great thing to kind of throw out there and end on. But I think about myself in those situations too, is like, even when sharing and helping or teaching, like I don't feel the way that I viewed people that I was scared to talk to, I guess. Like, I think when you're in a situation where you do need healing and you do need understanding, you're scared that the other person is going to look down on you because they are teaching you and they are better than you at that point, but they're not. Like, I want to emphasize that a lot, is like, even when a kid comes up to me to show, I'm like, man, I'm struggling, I'm addicted to this, and I'm trying my hardest. And in a teaching standpoint, I guess, because I'm them, like, I'm better now that I've gone through it, and you're still not there yet, but you'll get there.
Yeah.
So I just think it's more of like understanding and less teaching, I guess, just like understanding, but like, yes, I've gone through it and I got out the other side and you can too, but that does not make me better than you, that you're still in it. And I think that's a real big misconception. And that's where like the word teaching gets really fucked for people that are in that scary situation. They're already scared to talk about it. They don't want to talk to some guy that feels like they're teaching them something. Like, you know, fuck all that. 'Cause that's probably why you were doing it in the first place.
Yeah, totally. Like
that, you know?
And
I think just sharing my experience for anyone listening that might be in that situation that hasn't talked to someone about what they're going through yet, like, I swear I do not feel like I'm a teacher or I'm better than someone when I'm talking to them about an addiction that they're going through right now. I feel equal. I'm just like, yeah, I've done that too. And I'm right now, I'm okay. This role might reverse 4 years from now. I might see you at a show and be like, dude, I've been on drugs for 3 years. I need help. And you're like, hey, I got through it. You know, like,
yeah,
it doesn't make one person better than the other. It's just human compassion and loving and understanding. And that's the open mind I was talking about earlier, and just living open-mindedly and not looking at those people like you're better or worse. And that is like the most beautiful thing that I got out of growing up, period, and being where I am right now, is like, I talk to kids all the time after shows. Most of them are addicts or depressed, you know, had suicidal attempts or thoughts, and and I'm not like, oh, because I'm not doing that right now. I'm better than you. I really feel like I feel compassion and equal, and like to just, it's more about sharing that you're not alone. And a lot of those things, like suicide to me is a mistake, a split second mistake. We all think about it. We've all almost done it, and you made the right choice, but you can make a mistake. You can accident, you know, that thought. I'm like, I am going to pull the trigger. Or I am going to jump or whatever. Like, that's a mistake. And I'm not being, you know, insensitive to people that have lost someone to suicide, but I think I do believe it's a mistake that anyone would probably take back. Or at least I hope. And I think we're all capable of that. And the people that are scared to talk about it, to people that have lived through it and, you know, shared their stories like me and other singers and bands that have spoken about these things or lived through these things, is we're not saying that we're better because we've come out the other side. It's more like we're in it together. And the more we talk about it, the less likely chance you're going to make a mistake.
It's like when the Hulk discovers Thor and New Asgard in Avengers Endgame and says, you know who helped me out when I was going through a hard time? You did, Thor. That's how the relationship should be.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
It's mutual, and give and take.
Yeah. Feeling equal to people around you, whether you're standing on the stage or in the crowd, is something that we should all be doing.
In the pulpit or in the pews. You hear that? Yeah, yeah, totally.
You know, like, everyone's in it together. Hopefully that's how most people feel. Unfortunately, I don't think that everyone feels that way, but that's what we're trying to do.
You know? Well, on the days when I think the glass is half full, I think it's just that the people who don't feel that way are the loudest about it. And yeah. Maybe unbeknownst to themselves, what they're looking for in that loud discontent is some kind of harmony and some kind of place of belonging, even if their belonging is in a
negative way,
group of hate mongers. Yeah. Well, Spencer, I have greatly loved hanging out with you so much this week.
Yeah, man.
This is awesome. And thanks for doing this. You were, I'm like 20 something episodes deep. So I feel like I've said this a lot, but it's been true every time. You were one of my wish list people when I came up with this. Yeah. I mean, even, honestly, I think it was before the band got back together, even. I think it was still Sleepwave era when I came up with this idea, and I definitely sketched you in the notepad as somebody I wanted to have on.
I know we had talked about it before.
I think we were texting about it literally like a couple of years ago. So
yeah,
I'm glad made it happen.
I'm glad we did too.
And I'm glad it was now and not then, because, you know, so things happen for a reason.
The Sleepwave conversation on that bandwagon was, you know, that was a weird time. but I'm okay with it. You know, I think that's cool that, like, a lot of that stuff is, you know, all part of the journey. And
100%.
I hope no one walked away from it like, oh, that dude's fucked or that dude's lost. It was like, that's just part of the journey right now. You know, it was just like, there's different times. We all go through ups and downs, and even the downs are important.
And by the way, I didn't walk away from that night thinking that. It honestly didn't occur to me until seeing you earlier this week, how great you look right now is then when I realized how bad you looked then. You know what I mean? Like, at the time it didn't occur to me. I was just like, oh, it's Spencer. And then I see how healthy and happy and positive you seem now. And I'm like, oh, he wasn't like this before. If that makes sense, you know?
Yeah, there were some years, you know, that it got pretty dark, but that's just part of it. You know, without those times, I probably wouldn't be who I am now, or definitely
wouldn't you be who definitely I am would now. Not be. And you would have made the art that you have made then and are continuing to create now. It's all part of that story. Yeah. I mean, we could name 100 examples of great art that's come from struggle and tragedy and darkness, and that's where all the great stuff has come from. Honestly, I can't imagine there's much art that I've related to in my life that came from any other place, really. So
it's all
part of the journey. 100%. Awesome, man. Well, much love to you, your family, your lady, your pets.
my lady and my two pets.
And yeah, hit me up anytime. Always around for you. I appreciate these chats quite a bit.
Yeah, it's been great. Someday we'll get some good news about when we can all play music again and we'll actually run into each other in person.
That would be nice. That would be extremely nice.
Fantastic. I was thinking about it today. It's like, this is, I don't mind, I told you this on the last time we talked, but I haven't not, this is the longest I will go without getting on stage since I was probably 12 years old.
That is wild. I've
ever gone over a year. I don't think I've ever gone a year without playing at least, you know, I was playing once a month as a kid at the bare minimum since age 12 on in a venue, if not more. Like, we started doing regional stuff and all that by the time I was like 14. But man, I'm thinking about when we go away and write a record and stuff like that, it's never a year without playing. There's always a festival or something.
Some kind of fly-in or some kind of,
Yeah, dude, this sucks. This is bogus.
Well, here's my glass half full for you. What a gift it's been to have been able to do that so much so far, but not doing it for this amount of time seems so insane. There's your glass half full.